Looking through Daniel chapter 1, the introductory chapter to this Old Testament prophecy. If you've got a church Bible, you'll find it on page 883, just after the oh-so-well-known book of Ezekiel. Well, it should be fairly well-known. It wasn't that long ago since we did it. It's great. Did Lamentations, finished Lamentations last week, then comes Ezekiel, and now in Daniel. Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now, God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord the king who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men of your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus, 68 years later. Well, Daniel and his three friends outnumbered, alone. And so often that is Christian experience. Have you noticed? So often we are outnumbered. And that poses lots of questions. I mean, should we fit in? If so, in what ways? Should we stand out? Should we somehow be abnormal? Well, if so, how? Daniel is a wonderful book for any outnumbered believer. The book starts in about 605 BC, 600 years before Christ was born. Now, remember, although God had intended to reach the world through his people Israel, they had stubbornly disobeyed, and so the glory days of Israel are pretty much over by this stage. All that's left is the tiny kingdom of Judah, 605 BC. Foolishly, they've just rebelled against the superpower of the day, the Babylonian Empire, and they pay for it. Verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, this wasn't to be the final end of Jerusalem. That would come just over 20 years later, when Nebuchadnezzar had had quite enough of them. And that was the awful end of God's people in the Promised Land that we were hearing about even over the past 3 weeks as we went through our series in Lamentations. But even before that awful anticlimax, God was preparing a place for his people in exile along the eastern side of the Fertile Crescent of Mesopotamia. You can see the red star there, I pointed out. This red star here is the capital, Babylon. And that is where Daniel and many other noble young men were taken captive. In fact, in a lot of ways, I wonder if Daniel reminds you of another Bible character. It's rather similar to how God used Joseph at the end of the book of Genesis. You could call Daniel a second Joseph. He's the first one taken into exile, into slavery, but we'll see that God gives him favour with his boss. And he also gives him the ability to interpret dreams, just like Joseph. And that results in him being promoted to be the king's right-hand man. And very soon he pretty much converts the king. We'll begin to see that next week. And so the king recognises the Lord Yahweh as the only God really worthy of worship. And so Daniel, this second Joseph, begins to prepare a place for his brothers when they arrive in exile about 20 years later. Daniel, rather like Joseph, remains in exile his whole life. And what it says at the end of chapter 1, he remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. And that was the first of the Medo-Persian kings. 68 years later, at the end of the Babylonian Empire, he was still there serving at an extremely high level in the civil service. And remember, Cyrus was the important king who gave the decree to allow God's exiled people to go home, back to the Promised Land. So right in this introduction, we can see that the book of Daniel spans their whole exile in Babylon. He was one of the first ones to get there, and he was still there when they were allowed to return. The question is, you know, would God's people remain faithful in that exile? Well, Daniel shows them how. The meat of this chapter is a test of his loyalty to God, a vital lesson for God's exiled people, and therefore is vital for us too. Because remember, the Bible says we Christians are also in a kind of exile. We're not home yet. 1 Peter chapter 2 says, "Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us." So if you're a Christian, it's like you're a citizen of the city of God, but currently you're living in Babylon. Until Christ comes again to take us home, we're foreigners and exiles here, outnumbered. And Daniel's attitude sets us a great example. He was not of the world. He wasn't in it. He wasn't of it, but he was in it to win it. Not of it, so in it to win it. We're exploring that tonight. Now, do remember that he really didn't have it easy. He was utterly immersed in a pagan culture. It was really in his face. King Nebuchadnezzar had a plan not just to conquer his kingdom, not just to invade Judah, but to convert them. You will be assimilated. Don't know if you're into sci-fi. I thought of the Borg in Star Trek. There's this alien race that basically make other people, no matter what race they're from, exactly like them. You will be like us. That was his strategy. Verses 3 to 5. He orders his chief official to get these young men without any physical defect, who are really intelligent, to serve in the king's palace. But first, they've got to go through 3 years of Babylonian university. They're going to be taken from Jerusalem to King's College Babylon. They're going to change their language, their diet, even their names are going to be changed. They won't even remember who they were. That's the idea. And then Nebuchadnezzar will have succeeded in capturing the future of the Jews. they will be assimilated. And so Daniel and his three friends, given an imperial sponsorship to do an MBA, a Master of Babylonian Administration, and they're fast-tracked into imperial civil service. And their training, or more accurately, brainwashing, was to learn the literature of Babylon. Now, Babylonian culture, yeah, had astronomy and mathematics and science, quite advanced for that age. But it was all infused with many gods and pagan ideas. For Daniel and his friends, it was like being plunged into a bath of muddy water, and it threatened to seep into every pore of their being. They were immersed in a pagan culture. And if truth be told, we're pretty much almost as immersed, aren't we? I heard recently that the journalist Polly Toynbee said that the movers and shakers of culture today are found on the TV screens for all of us to see. People are immersed in the soap operas. That tends to be the lens through which British people reflect on life and understand their own lives. Soap operas portray what are the boundaries of normality in terms of crime and punishment, revenge and reconciliation, even the goodness and normality of family life. Even how you know what is right and wrong. Today it seems to be all about just do what's good for you. Even if God seems to have created things otherwise, if you feel a certain way, then just go with it. And that message has a powerful effect on the culture around us. You could say culture is far more dangerous to our identity as the people of God than any physical threat, than all the armies of Babylon. Because it's very tempting not to want to stand out. Who wants to be called a weirdo? So we start saying things like, oh, well, of course you should be whoever you want to be. Live however makes you happy. I live this way because it makes me happy. Or even we might start agreeing with people when they say, yeah, you don't have to live by biblical values. They aren't best for all people. We might not be scared into an ungodly compromise, but it's all too easy to adopt that without realizing it. That's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar wanted for Daniel and his three friends. Remember, behind all of this is an ultimate evil ruler, the devil, who wants all people to obey him, to rebel against the one true God, to worship what they see fit. Well, if Daniel was up against an explicit brainwashing, you can imagine for him it would have been very easy to say, enough, I don't want any of this, do whatever you like to me. I'm avoiding this. I'm resisting everything on every level. I'm withdrawing. It's been very easy for them to run away into a ghetto. And you see that even today in Christian culture. People who withdraw. You could call them rabbit hole Christians. They go into their little rabbit warren of Christian world. And you may see them occasionally outside the borough, but only because they're scampering across to the next borough. From one meeting to the next. They don't have any non-Christian friends outside that warren. No meaningful interactions with their colleagues. No life outside their local church building. But remember Jesus' prayer for us. John chapter 17. My prayer to the Father here is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They're not of the world, even as I'm not of it. Sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. And as you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. So we're not of the world, but he sends us into the world to win it. We're not of it, so we're in it to win it. Therefore, three negative things to say tonight. Firstly, don't withdraw. Don't withdraw. You notice that Daniel and his three friends don't oppose everything about the society around them, about their new position. They don't pass up on the opportunity to serve, even politically, for decades. It's quite likely they were aware of the words of the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah had sent a letter to King Nebuchadnezzar to pass on to the exiles. Jeremiah 29 verse 4 says, "This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Don't decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. God's plan was that Babylon, yeah, even Babylon, would be blessed through the exile of his people, through the presence of committed, godly people who would not withdraw from the pagan culture around them. And God was going to be present with his people to start transforming Babylonian culture. There's a hint of that in verse 2, where the articles from the Lord's house are taken to the house of the God of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. We'll see in chapter 5 the impact of idolatry there. Belshazzar will be judged by the presence of God. But there's a hint maybe that the Lord will go to bless his people. There's an even bigger hint in verse 4. Who was it that Nebuchadnezzar chose for his civil service? Well, it's young men without any physical defect. Literally, without blemish. And that's a word used back in Leviticus 21 to refer to blemishes on priests. It's like the Lord is giving a hint that these young men are going to act like priests, as living sacrifices, pure and unblemished, acting as representatives of God in exile, as God's ambassadors in a foreign land. And that is what we are today, a royal priesthood, his ambassadors declaring who he is, representing the Lord wherever he puts us, at every level of society, as teachers, IT specialists, cleaners, even snooker players. Don't know if you've been watching the World Championship, any nods? No, fine, it's just me. And politicians, yes, we want Christians in politics, and road sweepers, and doctors, you name it. And everywhere where we go, the world is going to be crying out to us, join us, yes, come in, fit in, blend in, be like us, don't rock the boat, just make your religion a private thing. When in Rome, you've got to do what the Romans do. In other words, you will be assimilated. The great danger as we try to be involved in society is the same as what Daniel faced, that we'll become worldly, that we'll compromise. Well, here's my second point. Don't just not withdraw, but also don't compromise. Don't compromise. Daniel, under serious pressure, has not just got to face this pagan education, but he's also had these pagan names imposed on him. New identities that had nothing to do with the Lord, the one true God. So, for example, Daniel, his own true name is God is my judge. That's the meaning of the name. His new name, Belteshazzar, means Bel, protect my life. Bel is a pagan god of Babylon. Hananiah means Yahweh, the Lord, has been gracious. Shadrach, his new name, means command of Aku, the moon god. Mishael means who is what God is. Meshach probably means who is what Aku is. And they're just trying to erase this whole idea of the one true God and substitute it with pagan gods. Similarly with Azariah, means Yahweh has helped, and they've made it, no, you're going to be Abednego, servant of Nego, who's probably another name for Nebo, the god whose name is included in Nebuchadnezzar's name. You see, these new names are a kind of adoption. In a sense, they're becoming sons of Nebuchadnezzar. And that's why he wants them to eat at his table. Come on, you're going to be members of my household. Utterly loyal to me, aren't you? What's Daniel's response? He's had these new names placed on him and his friends. Verse 8 is the pivot of the whole chapter. When the chief official places their new names on them, the direct response of Daniel is to place himself, same verb, not to be defiled. In other words, not to make himself estranged from God. He had to make a statement to draw the line, to say where his true loyalty still lay. I'm not going to compromise. Now, I can imagine around him are various young Jewish men who are saying, oh, no, come on, we've got to go with the flow. It's so clear who's boss around here. This is an unstoppable tide. You know, we've got common sense. We're going to go along with this. Got new names, got a new country, new jobs, a new king. Let's have new gods as well. Don't know if you know about the Swedish chainsaw with a warning sign on it that says, do not try to stop chainsaw with hands. Well, that was probably their attitude. You know, go with the flow, man. If you try to go against it in any way, you know, don't try to stop Babylon. It's futile. On the other side of the spectrum were the zealous purists who would withdraw into a ghetto and refuse to cooperate on every level. And you can imagine they didn't last very long. Well, Daniel will not join either party. He won't be a liberal or a hermit. Instead, he draws a line. Verses 8 to 16. Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Here's an awesome thing. God had caused the official to show favour and sympathy to Daniel. He's already ready to listen. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who's assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse, or possibly looking rebellious, than the other young men of your age? The king would then have my head because of you. Well, Daniel then said to the guard and the chief official that appointed over the four of them, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. And then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. And the amazing thing is, a miracle has occurred. On a diet of nothing but veggie burgers, they look better. Better than all the others. And more than that, God gives them not just great health, but also wisdom, understanding, all kinds of literature and learning. Daniel can even understand visions and dreams. The Lord graciously confirms Daniel's resolve not to compromise. But you saw right at the beginning how he makes a polite request. As he makes his stand, he is polite. He's not cantankerous and argumentative. No, he's gracious and tactful. He shows respect where respect is due. But you've got to wonder, why did he draw the line at meat and wine from the king's table? What was so wrong with it? And loads of people have got theories. Maybe the meat wasn't kosher. But that doesn't explain the wine, because the wine was kosher, according to the Old Testament food laws. Well, maybe it was that the meat had been sacrificed to idols. Well, actually, the same could be said of the vegetables. That doesn't seem to be the reason why he chose this diet. The most likely explanation is that there's no such thing as a free lunch, not in Babylon. To eat with the king was to declare absolute allegiance to him. To refuse to eat his food was to distance yourself. You don't own us, Nebuchadnezzar. We don't own your gods, all these new names. Our top allegiance remains with the Lord, after whom we are named. Now, some people love to draw lines, you know, really tight lines, don't they? Everything is a matter of principle. Everything is a reason to withdraw. They'd even separate from other Christians, even if they differ on minor points. The result is they've got no impact, because they're not in the world. Other people don't want to draw lines whatsoever. It's too hard, it's too unpopular. And the result is they end up utterly compromised. The result is they've got no impact because they're too much like the world. Please do not withdraw, but do not compromise either. We're sent into the world to reach the world. We must be in it to win it, because we're not of it. But how do we avoid compromise today? What lines should we draw? Man, I was discussing this with Joseph the other day. It is tricky. It's a lot of wisdom required, isn't it? In every area of our lives. What's right, what's wrong? Now, okay, on some things, God has been utterly clear. Even politicians should tell the truth, believe it or not. Even doctors should not murder. Even mechanics should not fiddle their taxes. But what about all the other questions? Like, how long is too long to work per week? I mean, some people, they work for 60, 70, 80 hours a week. Maybe they draw the line, well, so long as I'm there on a Sunday and at home group, I'll invest my life serving the Lord in this career. I'll make an impact despite the huge cost. It's a wisdom call. What if you can't make it, though, to the prayer meeting? What if you can't make it to midweek stuff very often? It's a difficult decision, isn't it? Each one to his own master will stand or fall. But as we'll see, we don't make these decisions on our own. That's why God places us in a community. Or another question, is it godly to own a BMW? I mean, what is a godly car to own? Is it a bit wasteful to have an Audi or a Lexus? Is it okay to collect DVDs or even to pay for gym membership? If you were to look at our lives objectively, imagine an Indian Christian comes and spends a month with us at Longmeadow. Would he not be amazed that we can justify living in such luxury? That would be his impression. You have more than two sets of clothes. You have this bigger house, you have a car, and you afford this hobby and that and that. We can't even dream of that. How can you spend so much on golf? But there is a wisdom call as we engage with our culture. It does cost time and money to be in the world. And that'll play out differently in different countries and even in different subcultures. It's very difficult, isn't it, for a consultant surgeon to get on well with his fellow consultants unless they've got some commonality in what they do. But there must be lines drawn. Otherwise you'll compromise. We must not compromise. We must not be assimilated. We have to draw the lines somewhere. Someone once compared it to slipping down an icy cliff. And you've got to shove down the ice axe at some point, or else you will eventually slip off the edge. You can't be exactly like the world. Draw the lines somewhere. And we need one another's help to do that. Can you think of any examples in your life or other people's lives where you've had to draw some lines not to compromise? Any examples? I've got two up my sleeve.
Children's sports.
Children's sports.
It can often take place on a Sunday morning. How do you decide, therefore, what you encourage them towards and how they get involved with making friendships and that kind of thing?
Should you let your children play football on a Sunday morning? Big question. Huge question. Yeah. I remember going out for a drink with some colleagues. I was delighted that they thought I was fit for their company. And we, you know, bought a round of drinks, another round of drinks. And they said, right, we're going to buy another round. And I'd already drawn the line. I was like, I'm only going to have two pints, that's it. They said, no, we're going to buy you another one. And they bought me another one, sat it down in front of me. Sadly, for the whole evening, it sat there. I felt terrible that they'd bought me this pint, but I'm not going to get tipsy. I'm just not going there. I can get relaxed, but I know what's going to happen if I have that third pint. I'm going to start saying stuff I'm going to regret. I'm not going to be a good ambassador for the Lord. There's a gazillion other ways, aren't there, that we want to live distinctive lives and draw lines. And let's face it, sometimes we're going to make mistakes and we need to learn. But recognize the Lord is a God of grace. A God of grace. Who will receive us if we turn back to him. But do remember, We need one another. Daniel didn't act alone. I know, you know, the book's named after him, but in his early career, he had these three friends to help him. If you flick forward to chapter 2, verse 17, we're going to find out next week quite what a predicament he's in. But verse 17 of chapter 2, he goes back to his house and explains this problem to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And he urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. That'll whet your appetite for chapter 2. But you can see there, his practice is to go back to his friends and to say, pray with me. This is a matter we desperately need the Lord's help with. We need heavenly wisdom, supernatural knowledge on this. And sometimes in life, we need to do that with one another, don't we? To say, look, I'm really struggling to know what I should do here. I know the word says this, and I know the word says that, but what should I do in my particular situation? If you're wondering where to draw the line, if you're at all concerned about compromise, then discuss it and pray about it with your Christian family. Don't withdraw from the world. Be in it to win it. Don't compromise, for we are not of it. But one last thing to say, because it is rather scary being an exile, being a stranger, being a weirdo, sticking out at times. A third negative for you. Do not fear. Don't fear. Because at every stage of life, it's very easy to be frightened, isn't it, by those around us. Classmates, parents, colleagues, bosses. They'll say, look, no one cares for your God here. So whatever other people are doing, you should do. Whatever he says goes. He's king now, not your God. Just keep your religion private. And sometimes the temptation is great. Because God seems so small compared to the earthly things that people live for that are all around us, you know, money and power. Perhaps that's how it seemed to the exiles in Babylon. But they knew something absolutely clear. Chapter 1, verse 2 explains the seeming weakness of God's people and their defeat at the siege of Jerusalem. Verse 2, the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. That's why the exile has happened. It does not say that the Lord is weak, that he's defeated by the gods of Babylon. No, their exile is his doing. And he's the one who's given them favour with the chief official when they stick their necks on the line. Okay, it doesn't always work out as cordially, as we'll see with the account of the fiery furnace. But God is the one in whose hands they live their lives. And as I mentioned, there's this astounding miracle that God makes them thrive on a vegetarian diet. Actually, I shouldn't say that so tongue-in-cheek. They do say a vegetarian diet is quite healthy. So if you have chosen that particular way of life, God bless you. But verse 17, notice another way in which they can see the Lord at work in their lives. He gives them phenomenal knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. Daniel can even interpret visions and dreams. Now, they couldn't demand that kind of grace from God. This is a generous gift from him to faithful men at just the right time in history. And so, verse 19, the king talked with them and he found none equal to these four guys. And they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better. It's like the 10 days, isn't it? Somewhat echoing. 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. One commentator says this, it's the irony of ironies. The four who disobeyed the king's orders are the four who show themselves to be exceptional. The four who refuse to align themselves politically with the king are the ones chosen for royal service. Moreover, the independence of these four from the gods of Babylon is underscored by the fact that we have their Hebrew names in verse 19. Rather than their assigned Babylonian names. The point is this, before they could get stuck into God's work, before he could use them, they had to be prepared to stick out. Before he could use them to win the world, they had to make a stand not to be of the world. What was it that gave them that confidence? Well, it was two things. Firstly, the knowledge that God is in charge of history. He is the one who caused the exile. He's the one who brought them to this situation, in charge of all their circumstances. He's the one who gives them favour with officials. He's the one who gives them all ability, all the skills that they have, all the knowledge that they've gained. And of course, we know another thing, that eventually would come one man utterly full of wisdom and understanding. One who would ascend to his father's right hand. One who engaged fully with the world, died to win it, and is now crowned to be King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He will return one day, and everyone will have to bow before him. There's our second reason not to fear, is that the most awesome Daniel has come. And he is reigning even now. And he will come again. Christ will return. So what are you afraid of? He wants to use you, even in the Babylon of your day. There's no need to withdraw, no need to compromise, and no need to fear. Yes, we're not of the world, but he's placed us in it to win it. I love what Jesus says in Matthew 5. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. Don't compromise. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp or put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. Don't withdraw. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. You're in it to win it. He will save people through you. Do not fear. Resolve to be salty. Resolve to be bright in the darkness. To distinctively shine. Will you resolve to do that right now? And will you resolve to encourage others, to lean on others for the wisdom, to draw the lines in the right places? Let's bow our heads. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the example of Daniel, above all for the example and teaching of Christ. The one who really never compromised. The one who shone brighter than any. The one full of wisdom. The one who brought and still brings people to praise you today. Forgive us for the ways in which we compromise and the ways in which we are not like Jesus. Forgive us for the ways in which we hide from the world. Help us not to bend over. Help us not to run away. May we not fear men because we fear you above all. We pray similarly for any Christian MPs in the run-up to the election, especially for those who will be voted in. May they be tactful and wise, but courageously distinctive. We pray for more Daniels of our day, who are prepared to serve in the halls of power, in government, for you and your glory. Please help each one of us, though, in our various callings to be salty and bright, to have lives full of such good deeds that others see and submit to Christ, and glorify him on the day when he returns. In his name we pray. Amen.